Merħba għal program Minajnejn Barranin fejn jiena Colin Fitz niltaqa' u niddiskuti pajjiżna ma' diversi persuni ta' nazzjonalitajiet differenti li għal xi raġuni u oħra għamlu lil Malta id-dar tagħhom. Il-programm jixxandar kull nhar ta' tlieta fit-tminja ta' filgħaxija b'repetizzjoni l-ħamis fl-10 ta' filgħodu, kif ukoll jinstab fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM. In today's program, Her Excellency, the Ambassador of the United States of America, Gina K. Abercrombie Winstanley, who has been the Ambassador for the United States to Malta for over 3 years now, and we're recording this program in November 2015. Will you be in the position, do you think, for much longer, or is the usual tenure 3 years?
The usual tenure is in fact 3 years, Colin, but our system is a little bit complex in that our parliament has to approve the president's nominees, and they do it in their own good time. So I'll be here until my successor has been confirmed by the Senate.
Right, so the Ambassador of the United States, the first American I'm interviewing for this series, and thank you very much for accepting. Please tell us a little bit about the first time you arrived in Malta, your 3 year period, or perhaps you had been here before, your first connection with Malta.
Okay. I had not been to Malta physically before, but my connection actually began with my father-in-law, who served here during World War II. And so he had been in and out of port with the English Navy and had very, very fond memories of his time here. So he brought my mother-in-law back after the war. So they had several trips to Malta. And my niece actually studied at St. Luke's Hospital as a nurse.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's such a fantastic connection. Did you say the British Navy or was he in the American Navy?
The British Navy, yes.
Because there was a big connection with the United States Armed Forces in World War II with several American military forces based here on the way to the invasion of Sicily, right?
Yes, that is correct. And we just had a ceremony about a month ago with the Massachusetts Artillery coming and setting up a plaque at the Upper Barraca Gardens in honor of those Americans who lost their lives and served trying to help protect Malta. So I'm very proud of that plaque. I've gone and taken pictures of it because it's a real reminder of the American connection with Malta.
And another reminder of this connection is the citation by President Roosevelt on the side of the palace in Valletta.
Absolutely. That citation speaks of the great admiration that Americans have had for Malta for a very long while. Yeah.
Just to conclude on this point, I believe the connection with the U.S. Navy goes back to the 1700s or 1800s when the United States Navy first entered the Mediterranean. I'm a bit of a history fan, that's why. So for anybody listening who doesn't know this, it's quite an interesting story.
Yes, when we were engaged with the Barbary Pirates is when we first had a connection with Malta. So that's very true, yeah.
So the connection with Malta goes back quite a long time. So you've been in the foreign service of your country for a very long time, and then 3-4 years ago it's announced that you are going to be the ambassador to Malta. What were your first impressions, your first thoughts, your first reactions?
Speaking very honestly, my first reaction was, oh dear, I don't know if I'm going to be suited to it because I have served in very difficult, very challenging places around the world. And all that I knew of Malta and our relationship was that it was strong and that it was good. And I was concerned that I wouldn't be kept busy enough while I was in Malta, in all honesty.
Oh, because the relationship is good, so you wouldn't have much to do.
Exactly.
So how did that change when you eventually did arrive, your very first impression when you came off the plane, and how did what you're saying develop? Were you kept busy after all?
Yes, and my first impression, I think, is like everyone's impression who gets off a plane in Malta, is that, wow, what a really lovely place. And you can see the history visually, and as an American, I think perhaps Europeans may not be as impressed as Americans are, but we are a very new country. Things that are close to 100 years old are considered quite old for us, so it's really an extraordinary thing, as you know, the history, the depth of it that is here in this very small place. I will say that I was told by our Deputy Secretary of State, when I expressed my concern to him, and I said, I don't know if it's tough enough for me. And he said, it may have been a garden spot, a vacation place in the past, because we've sent political appointees here since the mid-80s until me. And not that they didn't do good work while they were here, but usually when a political appointee wants to go to some place, it's usually because it's a very nice place. But he said that we have joint challenges, America and Malta, that need to be addressed and need to be addressed by someone who has experience in this region. And so I was selected because of my Middle East, North Africa background, and sent to Malta because of Malta's long expertise and experience with North Africa. And we have been working very closely since my arrival, and I know we started a little bit before with the evacuation of Americans and others from Libya. Malta, of course, played a very important role for which the American people are absolutely grateful. But we work very closely with Malta on training and issues with regard to North Africa and those countries that are struggling to find their way and their balance after the Arab Spring. So that's why I, as a professional diplomat, was sent here.
So Malta is a kind of, in the eyes of your bosses in the United States, Malta is a kind of frontier place that has all this exciting stuff and important stuff to the United States happening south of its borders?
Absolutely. And of course, as a member of the European Union, we have a very close and cooperative relationship as well. But the issues are such that I will laugh when I leave Malta and think, and I thought I wasn't going to be busy enough. I've been plenty busy.
Can we elaborate a bit upon the fact that you were the first non-political appointee? So what you're saying is Malta was considered even more important than before, so they placed an expert rather than someone who perhaps doesn't have that much experience but was placed here for political reasons, as happens in every country.
That's exactly right. Not to toot my own horn, but I do have long experience in the region. Have had a joyful as well as successful diplomatic career, and the time was right to send a professional back to Malta to work on the business at hand.
In fact, let's elaborate a bit about this, and we can talk about the social aspects of the places you've lived in as well, apart from the importance of the work you've done. It says in some of the research that I've done about you, you're the first woman diplomat to have led a U.S. consulate in the gender-conservative Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
You've also worked in places like Iraq, Baghdad, way back in the time of the Iran-Iraq war, Egypt, Tunisia. You've been posted to Israel. Could you elaborate a little bit about each of these?
Well, each of those has something in common, which is usually a very challenging professional atmosphere. Not always the best relations with the United States. There have been issues in each of those countries. We are always very focused on the importance of supporting civil society. In Malta, there's certainly work to be done, as in every country, but in most of the places I serve, civil society is nascent, it's small, it's underdeveloped, so that it's easy to see where you need, as a diplomat, as an American diplomat, where you need to give your attention, which organizations need our support, our advocacy, sometimes our money, just to keep going. So in all of these places, that was a major focus of my portfolio, but depending on where it was. In Egypt, I was a human rights officer, the labor officer. In Indonesia, I followed students and opposition groups. In Iraq, I was a human rights officer, which was a very challenging thing to do at that particular time. So all of these places have that in common, as well as for the, I think, the majority, because even in Israel, I was covering the Gaza Strip, so I was covering Muslims in Gaza. So I have a lot of interaction with the Arab world, with Muslims around the world, and that culture and those politics. And that, those cultural traditions. And I would say that those cultural traditions are one of the things that I found almost most at home here in Malta.
This is exactly what I want to talk about next. Here in Malta, you've been very active taking part in cultural traditions and some newer cultural traditions. Personally, I've seen you attend the Fashion Week events, for example, quite regularly. You've organized musical events and attended the theater. Speaking about the other countries you've lived in, this is all in the interest of comparing Malta with the United States and all the other countries. What was the cultural life in some of these other countries you've lived in as compared to the one in the States and your life in Malta?
Sure. Well, of course, I can give lots of compliments about Malta's culture and the great talent that you have here, and I'd love to talk about that a little bit. Some of the differences, of course, are the accessibility to a wide range of cultural activities. I think the easiest place was Indonesia, a majority Muslim country, but a very moderate one, with interesting Asian overlays or undertones, as well as the Islam that is there. So gamelan dancing, for instance, or theater, which is very stylized, very interesting in Indonesia. I would say that in every post I've been to, including Indonesia and Egypt and Iraq, I found choirs to join. So I've sung around the world. You can always find music. Theater is harder to find in the Middle East because it's a very Western tradition versus Middle Eastern tradition. But there are so many other ways of identifying the culture, including through textiles, which in every country of the world, you find the local textiles, you find a rich heritage of materials used, of dyes used, of colors used. I mean, just glorious. I must admit, my interest in fashion and clothing and how women in particular adorn ourselves has a long history, and so I was eager to find it here in Malta as well as finding it around the Middle East and in Indonesia as well. And so I'd say those two, fashion and music, are things that I've been able to find in every country.
And the fashion and music, and we talked a bit about theater as well, that you have experienced in Malta. Mm. Do you find that there is that you've been exposed to enough indigenous Maltese fashion, music, singing, and theater, or is our sort of culture and entertainment world too dominated? Maybe that's a good thing, by American, British, that kind of tradition.
Interesting question. I believe that I have found a great deal that is indigenous. I mean, everyone finds the festas and the villages and the fireworks and all of that, which is perfectly lovely and pleasant. You have a great deal of talent in the fashion world, I have to say. It's the new designer shows that I love, and of course the established ones as well. But I have seen young men and young women with extraordinary talent. I understand because Malta is small, people need to go outside to get seasoning, as it were, and perhaps identify their market because Malta may not be sufficiently large enough. But you bring it up, and I've been impressed, and no doubt you'll see me at future fashion weeks here in Malta even after I've left. The music as well, I can't comment about the dominance from outside. I mean, I know opera is very popular here, and I've seen more opera in the last 3 years than I have in my entire life beforehand. So you've got great talent in the musical sphere as well. The orchestra is one of my favorites. I love going to hear your the Philharmonic Orchestra, and I've been impressed with the talent there. Again, it's something that I do around the world, so I have a wide range to compare to, and have been very much impressed with such a small place, how much music is here, how much art is here. And like any country, there are other things that you will be able to do, perhaps should do, and that is, in my view, nurturing the younger talent as well. There are a lot of old masters on folks' walls around the country, in palaces and in private homes, but also nurturing the newer talent, the young people, to see what Malta looks like from modern eyes, what Maltese look like in modern eyes is also very important.
Tell us a little bit about your singing and the kind of singing you've done in Malta and your experience in the choir, because, in fact, it was one of the main stories that hit the papers when it was announced that you were going to be the next ambassador. The Times of Malta ran the story about, or perhaps it was an interview, I don't recall now, that you were very much into singing and that you intended to do some here in Malta.
I don't think it was an interview, but I did almost sneak, really. I belong to a really fabulous choir in Washington, and, you know, being sworn in as ambassador was the culmination, the realization of a dream. Regardless of where we end up, when you join the foreign service, even if you're not honest about it, we all join to become ambassador. That's what we're aiming for. And you know, those of us lucky enough to make it are thrilled to do so. And this being sworn in as America's representative, I can't think of anything more important, more humbling to be able to do. And I wanted this choir that had been such an important part of my life to be a part of the swearing in. And I say important part of my life because during my time of singing with the choir, my mother passed. And she was in Ohio, which is about an 8-hour drive from Washington, or flight. And I had been with her the night before, and she passed in the middle of the night and was with my siblings and at the hospital. And then we were going to regroup because people are not buried immediately in America. And I flew back to Washington, and I went straight into this rehearsal and got such love from the music and the people there that it was part of my healing of losing my mother. So I started to ask the question at the State Department, could I have a musical performance at my squaring in? And nobody knew because it hadn't been done. So I figured out, stop asking the question and just do it. So that's how I did it. And I just said, okay, I'm having people come in. What clearances do I need? How do I get them in the building, etc.? So I had this really glorious gospel performance of music, which, of course, is very lively, powerful music at my swearing in. And people really seemed to enjoy it. When I came to Malta, I knew I would want to join a choir, as I have everywhere else. But I did not expect to find gospel music in Malta, I'll be frank. And I was delighted to see you have at least 4 gospel choirs around the country. I was astounded.
I think we could blame Whoopi Goldberg maybe for that. Sister Act, the movie, was huge in this country when it came out in the 90s.
Okay. Well, thank you, Whoopi. I'll have to, if I ever meet her, I'll have to let her know. And so I started going to the concerts when they were available, and I went to one my first Christmas here in Gozo. And the director of the choir is from Gozo. And when I heard the performance, I said, okay, I got to join this choir. I have to audition and beg them to let me in this choir. And luckily, they were open to a non-Maltese being in the choir. I don't know if they've done that before, but they were very kind. And being able to sing gospel music here and sacred music, which is very important to me, and helped me also with my Maltese, because I've been singing in Maltese some of the songs. Before I joined that choir, though, I did have the honor to sing with the Co-Cathedral Choir. I rehearsed with them when I first got here, and I performed in Sijiwi with Maestro Bahadjo. He had written an oratorio, and I did the practice with them and performed with them there. The problem with that choir is that they do all of the formal occasions of the co-cathedral on Sunday morning, and I need to be sitting out with the diplomatic corps, so I would miss most of the performances with that choir. So I ended up not staying there.
Speaking of Maltese, you mentioned singing in Maltese. Have you learned the language while you've been here? Have you needed to?
I have learned much of the language. I had a teacher my very first year here who was absolutely brilliant. He was your former ambassador to Egypt. Ambassador George Duplessis was his name. And just a really good teacher, patient. I used to give him what I told him was my highest compliment, which was I was as happy to see him coming as I was to see him going at the end of the lesson, because it was always very exhausting one-on-one. But he passed on my first year. He died. And he was such a good teacher. I found it difficult to find another one, in all honesty. So I must admit that the progress that I made that very first year has atrophied because I didn't continue with the lessons. I'm pretty good in church. I might say because I'm too lazy to find an English language mass, but I've only done mass here in Maltese. So I have enough to certainly follow along and get the benefit of going to mass here. And wish that my Maltese were better, but I have enough to be polite and to communicate my enthusiasm. So that's good.
So you go to church here. Are you a Roman Catholic?
Yes, I am a Roman Catholic. You can be anything, obviously. So I happen to be Catholic, and we have many at the embassy and many who are not. I'm appreciative of the Maltese that I have learned, as I said, because it's helpful during the masses. And whenever I start to feel grumpy about it, because that means I have to work hard and really pay attention. You can't zone out when it's in a different language. Mm-hmm. I'm humbled because many of my colleagues, number one, are not Catholic, and several, of course, are Muslim, and they go to Mass the same way I go to Mass because it's a diplomatic invitation. Because of these similarities or the connections between Maltese and Arabic, they probably understand, you know, a fair amount as well. But I think, oh, well, you know, I need to be here anyway, so I can't really grumble about having to be in Mass.
No, the reason I ask is perhaps a lot of us Maltese don't know how many different religions are practiced in the United States. We see sometimes references to Roman Catholicism, Protestantism, but then there's Lutheranism, there's the Muslim faith. A lot of people are Jews as well. So there's a wide variety.
Holy Rollers, AME, which is African Methodist Episcopalian. I mean, yes, lots and lots.
Is there a majority religion in the States, or does the country not approach religion in that way?
Protestantism is the majority, although there's so many small, Southern Baptist is different than Baptist, for instance. There's so many different interpretations of that. They can be really, really different. And so there's lots, and anybody you meet can be anything. So it's not something that we talk about a great deal. I know that compared to Europe, the United States is considered to be far more religious than Europeans are in general, although we don't come anywhere close to Malta.
To go back to your foreign service before we talk about your childhood, which is something I want to talk about as well, living in the States. When you lived and were ambassador in Saudi Arabia, there was an attack, an Al-Qaeda attack on the compound where you lived. Am I right?
That's correct. At the time, I was the consul general, which is the senior diplomatic leader, principal officer in the Western region. I was responsible when I got there for about 20,000 Americans live in the Western region. It was the New York to Riyadh, which would be Saudi's capital. Mm-hmm. So it was a business center. It's a commercial center of Saudi Arabia. And a number of American companies there, fewer when I arrived, because I arrived after 9/11. But still, about 20,000 Americans were there. As the security situation became less stable, more Americans departed. But there were still lots in the oil sector lots in the defense sector, so a fair number. The attack happened in December, and this time of year is when it comes to mind again, because it was just about approaching this time, as I said, in early December.
It's obviously a very painful memory for you. If you wish not to speak about it, perhaps we could move on.
Well, what I will say, it is painful because I lost friends and colleagues. People died. People were trying to shut down the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. They were trying to make us afraid of sharing our values and our ideals and our ideas. And that is something that will not happen. It will not happen. So I am proud that we as a mission were able to pull ourselves together with a great deal of support from Saudis. It was amazing, the outpouring of support that came from many Saudis in Jeddah and even outside of the city, but who said this does not represent us. And we want and need our relationship to continue. So I'm immensely proud of the people with whom I worked at the time and who came after to continue that very important work that we were doing.
Let's go back to a happier time, your childhood. Ohio, I believe, is where you were born and raised. Could you tell us a little bit about life in the United States, particularly where you lived, to lead us into your life here, what comparisons you can make, and also what things are completely different?
I'm from Ohio, which is in the midwestern part of the country, the middle part, from a mid-sized small city, really. I'm outside of Cleveland, Ohio, which is a mid-sized city, but I'm from Cleveland Heights, which is small, 65,000 people. Birkirkara, maybe? knowing, as I do here, our neighbors, we were a very open neighborhood, block parties, little mini-festas, I suppose you might describe it as. The weather is cool in the summer, and really cold in the winter with lots and lots and lots of snow. So I'm really happy to be in Malta in the wintertime when I think of growing up in Ohio. So cold that the snow squeaked when you walked on it. I won't be living there again in the winter in any event. But very pleasant childhood. We were, I think, naive, or we just lost our house keys all the time. So I lived in a house that was very seldom locked because you could run in and out, and we were never burgled, we were never robbed, nothing like that.
This was the 70s when you were growing up?
The 70s, yeah.
Would it still be that way now?
I believe so. I believe so, because I think the neighborhood hasn't changed that much, but perhaps not. It's hard to say because it's been a while since I've lived there. I would say a very broad array of friends. I had friends of my own religion. There were a lot of Jews that lived in Cleveland Heights, so lots of synagogues around. We didn't have a mosque in Cleveland Heights, although I think that's changed since then. But Protestants, Catholics, Jews, and it was not an issue. We didn't talk about it. We just got on with the relationships and the friendships.
So you grew up, you started growing up, you went to university, was it in Washington?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in Washington, D.C.
And is that was that very different to Ohio? I mean, America is a huge place, sometimes very hard for people such as myself from a small country to imagine, and I've never been to the States yet. So is Washington far away from where you were brought up, and what were the differences that you had to get used to?
Yes, Washington is far, and in fact, it was my very first plane ride when I was 18 years old going off to college. I hadn't been on an airplane before. Every place, you know, Americans love, we love our cars. So even though we'd taken journeys, we always went by car until then. Washington, the physical city, is very different from Cleveland or Cleveland Heights. The housing stock in Washington is generally older. Although their houses nothing's old compared to Malta, of course. You know, 100 years old in Washington. The houses are generally smaller than they are in Ohio because we have a lot more space in Ohio. And I remember when I first went to Washington and saw what we call row houses, attached houses. I was like, whoa, what's wrong with those houses? Why are they all mushed together like that? But that's what many houses in Washington look like. They're attached. In Ohio, we have big houses, backyards, front yards, two-car garages. That's what I grew up with. So being in the confines of a city was a very different experience. I remember being quite excited when I got to university because the drinking age in Ohio has always been 21. It was never lower than that. And in Washington, it was 18. You could have wine and beer. And I remember being very excited for my first glass of wine, legal anyway.
Yeah. I remember those times. Yeah. I mean, we have it at 17, 18, I think, as well here. So
yes, 17 here. My daughter at 17 informed me she could drink legally here. And so also a wide variety of people at my college. A lot came from the Northeast, so New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts. So I was meeting people outside of the Midwest, and they have a different way of speaking. We have very regional accents in the United States. So that Boston, that Massachusetts accent, that New York, New Jersey accent, it sounded very odd to my ears. And we have different words for different things. In the Midwest, we call Sprite and Coke, etc., we call it pop. Maybe soda pop in the Midwest, and they call it soda in the East. And soda in the Midwest means like Perrier, it's sparkling water. So some linguistic things I had to figure out being in the eastern part of the country.
So it's the same country, albeit different states, but you have different names for things from one side to the other.
Absolutely. There are definitely regional differences in the language. Yeah.
That's incredible, the diversity. What about here in Malta, your family? You mentioned your daughter. How did they adapt to living in Malta, and what was their impression?
My family has enjoyed their time here very much. My daughter spent every summer here, and she worked while she was here. Perhaps to the shock of some people, but I'm a great believer in if you need money, you should earn it. And her first summer here, she worked at the Hard Rock Cafe as a bus girl. And I can tell you she was much more pleasant around the home once she understood the effort that needs to go into getting the table set and cleared and dinner parties, etc. So she was it was a learning experience and a maturing experience to go through that. And then I laughed because her father and I, we joined all the parents on the edge of Pacheville because the Hard Rock Cafe she worked in was the one just on the edge of Pacheville. And she worked until 2 and 3 in the morning on the weekends. I mean, it was very long hours. I thought too long as a parent, but she was 16 and it was really important to her that she have this job and that she do it the same way everybody else did it. She didn't want any special favors. But we would go and pick her up, and so we'd be sitting out there parked and see all the other cars of parents waiting for the children to come out of Pacheville. And I said to my husband, I can't believe we're doing this. I can't believe we're doing this. But anyway.
Can I just interrupt you? Bus girl, you said? That's one thing that I didn't quite understand. Was she a server?
No, she didn't get to be a server. She had to clear the tables and set the tables. So busing the table means to clean it.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So bus girl the first year. Then the second year, she worked at the Hilton Hotel as a server. So she moved up on the one hand because she got to serve people, but she did it at the poolside restaurant. And I remember her first day of work there, and she came home, and you know, summer is hot here, and she had monstrous blisters on her feet. And I thought, oh my goodness, she's not going to make it. But she did. She did not quit. We bandaged up those feet, we got her a new pair of shoes, and she went back. And I'm speaking with a great deal of pride because I know how hard it is, A, to work, B, to do it outside, and C, to do it in a place where your friends are coming to hang out at the pool and you're going to have to wait on them, which she did. I thought she did a great job. It was a tough job. And then the last year she worked at the embassy in our public diplomacy section for the most part. And I think that was probably the job she enjoyed least, in all honesty.
She didn't get to work with so many Maltese then.
She didn't get to work with as many Maltese. It was an indoor job at a desk and computer, and she was working on doing subtitles for some of the videos, which is very important work. But when you're outside and in the sunshine and running around, I think it's easier to keep from being bored. I mean, she was just on her feet all the time. So I think she may do something more hands-on than I do. I don't know what she's going to end up doing. But she worked very hard her 3 years. Her brother, my son, who's a bit older than she, also worked in the embassy, but then he started university, so he couldn't come out in the summers as easily as she.
Or what you call college in the States.
Yes, that's exactly right. I was speaking Maltese.
Yes, thank you for my benefit. And your husband, what about his life here in Malta?
Yeah, my husband came. I told him I wouldn't come unless he came. It's very, I don't know, rare for women in particular or for people in general. When you get to our level, oftentimes both spouses are working, and so for one to give up their job to come be with you is a huge gift, sacrifice. So my husband quit his job and gave me 3 years here where he could not work because he was my husband. We have nepotism rules, so he couldn't work at the embassy. It was a challenge to look for work on the local economy, and he decided that he didn't want any ethical issues or questions, so he volunteered his time while he was here. He worked with a local organization that works on environmental issues and patrimony issues, restoring and maintaining some of the beautiful architecture that you have here.
Edin tisamaw il-programm Minajnejn Barranin fuq Campus FM li x-xandar kull nhar ta' tlieta fit-tminja ta' filgħaxija b'repetizzjoni l-ħamis fl-10 ta' filgħodu, kif ukoll jitstab fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM. The Ambassador of the United States of America, Madame Jean Abercrombie with Stanley. You come from a country that is very diverse, is the melting pot, is very multicultural, is very successful, and yet even the United States has some racial issues sometimes. We hear nowadays of the occasional incident involving the security services, protests with placards saying Black Lives Matter. Malta has only experienced diversity, or started to experience diversity, relatively recently. I still remember, as a child in the 1980s, the only black person I knew who lived in Malta, or two, were a couple of soccer players and a basketball player, a fellow called Don Ross. I can mention him by name. Eventually, in the 90s, more footballers came, and then eventually migrants, as well as, of course, European Union. But it's still a developing thing, and perhaps some observers feel there is a bit of a race issue existent in Malta, as there is in many other countries, or most other countries. Can I have your views about this, particularly in the light of your experience here?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I have to say is I have been in an extremely privileged position, so everyone's very nice to me. When they don't know who I am, which happened more in my first year than now, of course, there might be a coolness in their reception to me. I will admit noticing that from time to time. I usually addressed it by speaking in Maltese, or giving a bonjour and a kifinti, and all right, and then seeing their eyes get wide, and usually a smile comes immediately after, and they respond. So I believe learning a local language is extremely important for anyone who's living as a guest or a resident in another country, that makes a real difference in how you are received and perceived. If you're making an effort to really get to know and blend in as best as possible, as well as bringing what you personally bring to a country, I think that makes the transition easier. I will absolutely admit to concerns about my children. My daughter is, I guess, medium brown, and certainly told me she felt different from time to time. She, you know, talked about her experiences sometimes with work and how people perceived her until they understood that she was American, and sometimes was less comfortable than others. My son is very dark brown, and I did worry a great deal about him, particularly if he was going to go to Pacheville, because I've heard that sometimes people of color, particularly young men, can face discrimination. I know I had Marines here, a young Marine who is African American, and she had terrible things said to her when she was out socializing in Pacheville. And I was saddened to know that these experiences happen, and I know that people who are strangers around the world suffer this way, because I've heard of Maltese and things that were said to them that when they were new immigrants in England or Australia, perhaps the United States as well. And that it's when you are the outsider. And I think all of us need to hold on to the fact that there but for the grace of God. And when I have Maltese, because I talk about these issues, say to me, ah, well, these people, they're coming, talking about refugees or migrants are coming. And when we had to go, when we went, we were wanted. Australia wanted us to come. England wanted us to come. And I always say, whether you are welcome is not at all relevant to the fact that you had to go. It wasn't that somebody wanted you that you decided to pick up and leave this gorgeous island. You had to go because you wanted to provide for your family. And so if you think about what drove you away from this place that so many people consider paradise, then you must understand what drives people, whether they are legally migrants or legally refugees. What makes someone abandon the only home that they've known and take such a treacherous and dangerous journey to try and find a better life or to provide for their families? And the people who do that, I believe, as my father used to tell me about slaves that made it to America, he would say, darling, the best ones survive, because the weak ones are the ones who died on the middle passage on the way over. The strong ones are the ones who were able to make it. So when you think about the people who had the get up and go, the courage, the endurance for the psychological and physical traumas of making this journey, then by my goodness, those are the ones that should be able to contribute in a major way to the economy and the life of wherever they are ending up. And I believe that absolutely.
And hopefully integrate into multi-society and contribute in that way as well, and so that we become one big happy nation in the future.
A happy nation is hard. You know, human nature is human nature. But certainly a successful integration, and regardless of the challenges that African Americans and other minorities face in the United States, and we certainly do, no one is gainsaying the fact that we are American, that we have a right to be there, and that all of us need to work together to improve those racial relations, the status of all of our citizens, because the reality is when you have people left behind, feeling marginalized, feeling angry or disaffected, it's going to cost everyone. It's going to cost everyone. So we all have to work together on that.
Forgive me, but I'm going to dwell on this point a little bit longer, because we've discussed in detail, and I agree with what you've said about the plight and the situation regarding the migrants and the refugees. But earlier you mentioned that, for example, your daughter would face a bit of a hard time sometimes from some people until they realized she was American. Do you feel that there is also a problem, a prejudice problem, in some sectors in Malta where if you're a black American, then it's okay, but if you're a black African, then you're considered perhaps not so intelligent or something? Do some people have that prejudice, and is it a widespread issue here?
It's hard for me to say. I think that it does make a difference, your nationality or how you look. So I was very clear on, well, not that I needed to be, but certainly with my children, please dress very well at all times. But that's just being respectful and presenting the best possible face to the world. I do believe that you probably get more of a pass or a pause, and that might be just economics. As an American tourist, you're coming, you're able to stay in hotels and spend money, and it generally helps. I will say, though, that I was told, and I know that my predecessor ended up writing a letter to the editor or an op-ed, I can't remember which it was, because his secretary, his assistant, faced overt racism here in Malta, so much so that she left Malta early, and she was African-American. And I did speak with her after she left here, and she said, it was very tough for me. It was very tough for me. And I think in the incident that occurred, I think she did say that she was American, and it didn't matter to the proprietor that she was American. He didn't want her in his establishment.
So these things do happen here. How do we fix it? What do we do?
Well, you know, I think there are a number of things. Education, in the United States, we use public service announcements a lot. Advertising makes a difference a lot. I'm old enough to remember when people of color were not on television at all. You didn't see all the products were for European Americans or majority Americans. And then increasingly you see, oh, there's someone black in that commercial, whether they're buying a car or using a shampoo, etc. And so advertising makes a huge difference. When you see diversity, you know, in magazines, on television, it is a way of helping people get used to it, number one, and reminding them that everybody is working for the same things. Everybody is looking for a good life, a comfortable life, a meaningful life. And seeing people in a range of occupations. I mean, the joke now in the States, you see all these TV shows and the judge is always black. You know, you have a black judge or black police lieutenant or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the black police lieutenant is the cliche nowadays, who shouts a lot, isn't it?
Sorry, yes, well, that's very true. But having people in these roles, and, in 24, I guess it was, the president was black before we had a black president.
Yeah.
Who knows how much that helped make people ready for having a black president in real life? I don't know. But I think that that is something that can be very helpful. I do.
Let's move on to happier things once again. The things that you love the most about Malta, the things that you will take with you when you eventually have to leave.
Madonna. How? I'll take that word with me.
Really? Have you found Maltese words slipping into your conversation?
Don't laugh. Absolutely. In fact, it happened when I was out with some Arab friends, and I said, Madonna. And I thought, oh, okay, that's not going to work in this crowd. But, yeah, so I definitely have some Maltese words that are coming naturally now.
Things like Mela and...
Mela I don't use so much. My daughter uses Mela. My daughter uses Mela, but I don't use that one. Madonna, really, when I'm exclaiming about something. Or how I'm feeling, because most days here I'm feeling absolutely bumba. And yes, so I use that a lot, happily, because it's how I feel.
Yes, but you mustn't say it in an airport situation or a security situation.
I have been reminded. The stereotypical things, so I have to mention, everyone knows, being able to walk outside my door and the sun shining most days is a blessing. I like sunshine. It's one of the reasons why I really love Saudi Arabia, because the sun shone every single day I was there. So I like sunshine.
But surely Saudi Arabia was hotter than Malta.
It was much hotter. But as long as the sun is shining, you will not hear me complain. That's okay. I can do heat. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of exercise. I walk the island. I can't think of a village that I probably haven't walked through or around or nearby, because I have eaten a great deal of Maltese bread, a lot of it. And so I exercise to make sure people can't see it on my body. I will take away from here, and I mentioned early on in our conversation that some of the cultural traditions in the Middle East made Malta feel immediately home-like to me, because I've spent so many years in the Middle East. I learned to be a good hostess from my time in the Middle East. And that tradition of hospitality, of generosity, of graciousness that I learned from Arabs is also here in Malta, where in America, when you come to someone's home, the tradition is this, to give them a glass of water, to give them something to drink. In the Middle East and in Malta, food comes with it. But it has changed the way I host people, even in the United States, whereas I might have offered people a drink before, I will offer food immediately at the beginning. And this is something that is very much present in Malta. So that generosity of hosting, of welcome, it's something that you really feel. If you are lucky enough to have a Maltese welcome you, it's a real welcome. And that hospitality is something that I have enjoyed, I have appreciated, and I will take with me and try and share with others.
So when you go back to the States or wherever else you will be going after here, will you be promoting Malta? Will you be telling people, listen, Malta's good, go to Malta, tourists, whatever?
Absolutely. I already do, but absolutely. We've had over 100 house guests, so I've introduced Malta to a whole lot of people, house guests staying here. And I tweet about it. You know, when I go walking, sometimes I take pictures and tweet them because it's a beautiful country. It's a beautiful country that Americans need to know more about.
You've made friendships that will remain forever?
I've already been extending invitations to people to come and visit, yes.
And about the point you just made, Americans knowing about Malta, do Americans in general know anything at all about Malta, or is it something that we need to work harder on here in this country to promote to the United States?
Most Americans do not know very much about Malta. It's not that it's so far, because Europe and North Africa are all around you, but that it's small, and probably the issue is that there are no direct flights. I think that's what makes a difference, that people have to go someplace, then go on to Malta. And so it's, you know, people come by ship, I guess, for the most part.
But cruise liners, you mean?
Yes, cruise liners. Mm-hmm. But when people come, they are astounded. They are astounded and delighted. And I believe that there is a huge market in religious tourism that Malta will be able to take advantage of when it looks in that direction.
So you think direct flights are the way forward to bring more people over from the States and improve communication between our two countries?
I think that that is something that makes a difference, having direct flights. But I believe there are other ways as well. As I said, I think religious tourism, the cruising, bring some Americans, and as Americans come, they talk about Malta, and more will come.
What about the American community in Malta? What can you tell me about that?
It is, compared to certainly our colleague from the UK, other European countries, it's small, often dual nationals, Maltese who went to the States when they were immigrating and then come back to Malta to retire. So we have a lot of dual nationals, a lot of Americans, Maltese Americans on the island of Gozo as well.
Yes, you can tell that from the names of the houses and the American flags flying. Back to the slightly negative things, the things that perhaps have upset you, or the things you think we could do better. I know you're a diplomat and you have to be very diplomatic, but is there anything that you feel Malta could do without?
Intermissions in the cinema. Oh, if you have to say, you know, what's different about Malta from home, or as Malta is my home now, what irritates, or I just shake my head over, it is the intermission in the cinema. And until everybody revolts and doesn't buy any food in the middle, then I know it's going to continue on. But there's no good place to break a movie. You're in the middle of an exciting movie, and then suddenly you've got an intermission. So that's my pet peeve about Malta, which isn't much of a peeve, but it is. A big improvement has happened over the last 3 years about people cleaning up after their dogs on walks. I'm going to be frank about that. It was pretty bad when I first came. It still happens, but far less. And I hope that we get to the point where everyone realizes that we're walking, and to curb their dog or clean up after their dog, whatever is necessary, because I do a lot of walking, and when people do, you just don't want to have to deal with that, and there's no reason for that. Just common courtesy. So those are my two Those are my two pet peeves.
Just a couple of final questions, and we'll round up. A lot of American movies have been made in Malta in the last couple of years since you've been here. And Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie and Michael Bay and Tom Hanks. Have you got to meet all these stars while they've been here, thanks to your position?
Well, in fact, for the most part, no. I'm sorry to say, I wrote a lovely letter to Mr. Hanks, and he said he would love to come to the embassy and meet Americans, but he was filming in the at sea, and that he was really not in Valletta, although we all saw the tweet that he did about the traffic, and we're all very sympathetic to that. With Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, I actually did get an invitation, but didn't accept it soon enough, so I did not get out there. I did get a chance to meet Michael Bay and talk about Malta and filming in Malta and how thrilled he was to be able to do some filming here, and hopefully he'll make some more movies.
Yeah, Michael Bay, of course, is the director of famous films such as the Transformers films, and he...
But his best friend, The Rock.
Oh, absolutely. I watched that one with, Sean Connery and...
Nicolas Cage. Awesome.
That's right. Sean Connery, Nicolas Cage. It was Alcatraz. And yes, absolutely. 90s film. Great film. So Michael Bay, and he's just done 13 Hours, which is the story of the Libyan incident that was all filmed here.
A story.
Okay, so you're telling us when we do watch the film, keep in mind that it's been fictionalized.
Yes.
That's the inside story, and you heard it here first, listeners. So, yeah, so these celebrities, Michael Bay, you were saying.
Yeah, I had a chance of meeting him and talked to him about Malta and hearing how pleased he was to be able to do the filming in Malta, which I think is great. I think those connections, commercial connections between the United States and Malta should be strengthened and will be strengthened. You have a great product here.
Right, so to conclude, your final few words about Malta. Will you be coming back?
Most definitely. I've been watching the changes that have already begun to be made in preparation for Valletta 18, and knowing that the whole island is being brought into this, I think it is. It's things are moving beautifully, and I'm seeing the resurgence in Valletta as well as many of the villages, and I look forward to coming to see what preparations have been made and how it's all going to play out, and being one of the many visitors that will come see Valletta, City of Culture.
Your Excellency Gina K. Abercrombie-Stanley, Ambassador for the United States to Malta, thank you very much for being on Minajdejn Baranin on Campus FM.
U dik kienet edizzjoni oħra tal-programm Minajnejn Barranin, fejn jiena kol il-fitz niltaqgħu niddiskuti t-tajjeb u dak li hu inqas tajjeb f'pajjiżna, ma' diversi persuni ta' nazzjonalitajiet differenti li għal xi raġuni jew oħra għamlu lil Malta id-dar tagħhom. Il-programm jixxandar kull nhar ta' tlieta fit-tmienja ta' filgħaxija b'repetizzjoni l-ħamis fl-10 ta' filgħodu kif ukoll tistgħu issibuh fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM.